Safety Subcommittee of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means for February 7th, 2005. Duly be noted that the chair, Senator Gordley, is excused, as is Senator Winters. With that, we do not actually have a quorum for the committee, so we will operate as an informational meeting only. I would like to note that we have all of our House members in attendance. And with that, we will start off where we left off with the Department of Justice presentation.
Mr. Chair, just as a only, there should be a packet at your table that looks like this. And that replaces, there's a couple pages on diversity, and then what's behind the green sheet is a replacement for the entire tab under priorities. Yeah, priorities in your book. For the justice book, not the collections book.
Okay. But you can start. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Leslie Polish. I am the Associate Attorney General of the Department of Justice, and I have been asked to respond to some questions that were posed about the diversity of the Department of Justice. So I have for you two slides. The first one will give you an overview of who we are today. As you can see from the box on the top, this is organized to show job categories that are defined by the EEOC, and then it, as you read across the page, you'll see the total number of employees at DOJ in those categories, and then they are broken out by gender and toward the other side of the slide by the targeted racial groups that are identified also by EEOC, as well as persons with disabilities. And the bottom box of this shows you where we stand over the last few years, our relative performance in the area of diversity. The department does employ women and persons of color in all job categories, with the exception of service maintenance, and we have only two employees performing those jobs. We have stayed at approximately the same level over the last 3 years during a time of shrinking budgets. In fact, we've managed to improve our representation of persons of color somewhat in the last couple of years. And as compared with the Oregon as a whole, the percentage of the workforce for women and persons of color, the members of the department are represented in higher proportions than they are in the statewide workforce. And I believe that the number of persons with disabilities is understated. In fact, I'm certain that it's understated, but we rely entirely on individuals self-reporting disabilities, and for obvious reasons, people are somewhat reluctant to do that. But we know that we are making numerous accommodations under the Americans with Disabilities Act, so I'm very confident in saying that there are more than this number, but I can't give you an accurate statistic. Next slide, please. Some of the things that the department is doing in order to promote a diverse workforce is we attend job fairs in an effort to recruit qualified people. For primarily persons of color, we attend the annual Career Connections Job Fair sponsored by the Urban League of Portland, and we also attend the Oregon State Bar Employer Forum for minority students. We actively participate in the Oregon State Bar's program for affirmative action by placing law students of color in our law clerk program. And for current members of the department, we have mandatory training in avoiding workplace harassment that is based on any of the protected categories. Attendance is mandatory as a condition of employment. All new employees attend the avoiding harassment training within 6 months of hire. And all current members of the department have a refresher training every 2 years. And this is fairly extensive. The initial training is a half a day, and the refresher training is 2 hours. We have also had executive training. At the invitation of Attorney General Myers, former Justice Edwin Peterson conducted a class on understanding racism. That was conducted over 6 weeks, an hour and a half session weekly for all members of the Department of Justice executive staff. We have what I believe is a model policy on domestic violence. This was developed at the instigation of Attorney General Myers, and it is, I think, the first one in state government. We have conducted training that's been mandatory for all managers on how to recognize when a colleague might be a victim of domestic violence so that we can provide them, upon request, with resources and support in the community. The training, as I said, was mandatory for managers. It was also offered on a voluntary basis to all employees of the department. And many women have come forward and have received very valuable assistance under this policy. We also maintain a site on our intranet, which is posted and updated regularly to tell people what's going on in the community in terms of diversity activities. And last but not least, we have a diversity committee that has been very active over the last several years. We have representatives of each of the divisions who sit on the committee. They meet once a month. And they are charged with the mission of advising and counseling the Attorney General on how to promote a diverse workplace. Some of the activities that they've been involved in, I'll give you an example. We created a book club that was to meet monthly and read at their own agreement, on their own time, of course, books on diversity topics, and they come together to share ideas over the noon hour. That now is ongoing. Several of these groups have taken this up, this project as their own. It's an ongoing project that changes books on a regular basis. And also, the committee assists with the planning and presentation of a continuing legal education course that we do every year on a diversity topic. The most recent one that we conducted was called Indian Tribes in the Courts and was received very well. So that is sort of a summary of what we have been doing in order to support the diversity of the members of the department. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Are there any questions for Ms. Kolisch?
Good job.
Thank you very much. Mr. Attorney General.
Chair?
Yes.
What is scheduled now is that the Attorney General will go through the priorities of the agency. He does have, there's a replacement, as we mentioned before, for the last tab in the notebook. Also in your notebook should be a lot, it would have been in the original when we passed it upstairs, your offices, and we don't have it now, is a legal side priority sheet, which is in the format that all agencies, or a similar format that all agencies are using. I don't think he will use this as part of the presentation, but this is the sheet we'll be using during work sessions. Just a couple comments on priorities, and each agency will sort of present a different type of structure and presentation in terms of prioritized lists, but a couple things to keep in mind as the committee works through these. These are working documents. They're work in progress. You as a subcommittee should be taking a look at discussing, suggesting, or instructing the agency to make changes that the subcommittee as a whole thinks are necessary. And then back later in the deliberations in mid-March, the subcommittee will come back and deliberate on the priorities within this agency. They vary significantly between agencies and the ones I've seen in terms of the level of detail broken down. The co-chairs have reviewed this one and made some suggestions on being a little more detailed in some areas, less detailed in others. I talked to some of the personnel from the agency, and they will likely be changing that along with any discussions that you bring forward this time before the mid-March pseudo work session on priorities. Also keep in mind, as part of this sheet, there are 10% reductions listed. In this case, this agency pretty much took them across the board, meaning there's this program, what does it mean to cut it 10%? Other agencies and the co-chairs, I think, would rather like to see the 10% prioritization, or the 10% reductions somewhat reflect a priority list also, so meaning that there are programs to reduce, take them off the bottom. So keep that in mind as the discussion goes through with this agency and other agencies and in terms of the prioritized list.
Mr. Attorney General.
Chair Devlin, members of the subcommittee, Hardy Myers, Attorney General, for the record. Earlier in Phase 1, we presented the subcommittee with an overview of the actual program and mission areas of the Department of Justice. Today, I'd like to conclude Phase 1 by reviewing the results of our first efforts at prioritizing those different mission areas as they've been established by the legislature for the Department of Justice. You may recall in the my opening presentation, I alluded to the mission statement of the department, part of which noted that though the missions of the department serve different constituencies, we view them as united by a common purpose, which is to advance and sustain the rule of law in Oregon. And so our prioritization is really an effort to rank, if you will, or prioritize the various responsibilities we've been given on behalf of the rule of law. And in sorting through them and organizing them, we've been governed by an effort to try to determine what we would view as the true core mission or missions of the department. We've looked at the question of the contribution of the particular area to public order and safety. We looked at the resource investment the legislature has made as another very important factor in determining the prioritization of the department. As a result of that effort, our first priority that has emerged is legal services to state government. We think that is the truly core mission of the Department of Justice, and our most important priority. Legal services to state government include about 35% of our budget, paid for, as we've described before, by legal services as set forth in ORS Chapter 180. This area of the department's budget is not recommended for reduction in the governor's recommended budget, and indeed there are two or three policy packages that actually recommend the legislature augment the resources of the department that are available to provide needed services, particularly, as you may recall, in the area of legal services to the Department of Human Services for child welfare cases. We've shown on this slide, though there is no governor's recommended reduction, a 10% reduction. We've been using the term LFO 10% through the earlier presentations, but just to clarify again, that 10% reduction refers to a statutory mandate the legislature enacted in 1999, which directs the governor to submit an alternative budget showing 10% reductions in all below the level of the governor's recommended budget. So that this LFO 10% reference, wherever it occurs, is really a reference back to that mandate of the legislature that the governor exhibit a 10% reduced budget from his recommended budget level. And that level, as shown here, would be 35 positions in the department, of which two-thirds, 24, would be attorneys, and 12 would be support staff. So a significant reduction in the resources.
Mr. Attorney General, since I am the acting chair and Senator Gordley is not with us today, I will grant you leniency in the use of acronyms, but I will have to fine you if you actually use an acronym again. LFO. LFO is obviously Legislative Fiscal Office, and thank you. He just defended the Legislative Fiscal Office, but it was not their requirement to do it.
Okay.
He provided you.
Noticed. Thank you.
Please proceed, Mr. Attorney General.
Yes. Senator Winters left me in charge of the donation pig, and I left it in my office, so we have no way to collect money, even if we wanted to.
He didn't break it.
Well, the weekend was a little more expensive than I thought.
Well, we will proceed, and if the good representative from Northport will provide me with an element of deniability. Please proceed, Mr. Attorney General.
Thank you for the warning, by the way, Chair Devlin, and one free pass on the issue of acronyms. But key factors that bear on our prioritization of this area of our work as priority number one are shown there on the screen. I guess I would center for a moment on the preservation of the rule of law as to state government in Oregon. That's the function of all of that work that's represented there. Includes, of course, the consolidated legal services structure that I described earlier, efforts to ensure uniform interpretation of law, application of law throughout the government. And these are services that are, for the most part, responsive to agency requests and to actions of others, such as litigants filing cases against the government. And really, our statutory responsibility to provide legal services is the obligation of the department that is really at risk in the decisions made around this area of service. But I guess I would say that in my experience, this area of the department's work has been approached by the legislature on a, I think, wholly nonpartisan, non-ideological basis. I think it's been viewed as a good government issue of a very, very fundamental nature. Its law-based footings are in ORS Chapter 180. And while there are various federal laws that bear on it, we've noted one very important one, which is the Safe Families and Adoption Act, Public Law 105-89, which drives a lot of the government's work with respect to the ultimate disposition and placement of children who come within the jurisdiction of the state. The communities served are all state agencies, and the citizens and organizations affected by the operations of those agencies. The impact of the, instead of proposed reductions, again, we're talking about the mandated 10% alternative budget reductions, would be significant reductions in department personnel, and the expectable outcomes of that in terms of reducing the accountability of the government to the rule of law, diminished legal services, reduced response times, and unmet requests. Which can in turn lead to increased reliance on expensive outside counsel. And it is vastly more expensive, as I think you'll learn in more detail probably later in this process, it is vastly more expensive to go outside the Department of Justice, outside the government for legal services. But the other consequences as shown there include increased backlogs in various caseloads, potential increased exposure to civil liability, decreased recoveries for state agencies, overall reduction of the number of cases in which the state prevails. All, I think, fairly expectable and predictable outcomes. Our second priority area, services to support children and families, the child support program and the Division of Child Support. And I think the prioritization of this program area is driven dominantly by both the size of the investment that the legislature has made in this program area and the department. It's about 40% of our budget. And also by the sheer number of Oregonians who are implicated, whose interests are implicated by this program. About 250,000 active cases, as we reviewed before, representing probably at least 500,000 children. And this program area has not been recommended for any reduction by the governor's recommended budget. The 10% mandated alternative reduction budget would show a reduction of about $11 million spread over general, other, and federal funds, about 60 FTE, which includes managers, caseworkers, payment clerks, technical staff, and others. Key factors involved in the prioritization: the direct financial benefit to Oregon children, key resources to district attorneys, the important leverage of federal dollars on the 2-to-1 match, and the recovery for various state programs.
Senator Duff?
Yes.
Representative.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you.
Could you help us understand, if we backed up to the last page of the reductions, the LFO recommended reduction of 10%, it was almost $10 million, 35 FTE. This one's over 11.5, but it's double the number of FTE. Is there any relationship between the dollars and people? I mean, is there an explanation for $2 million different and almost twice as many people?
Yes.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Mr. Wilson.
The major reason is the first priority is mainly made up of attorneys and their support staff, which are likely paid significantly higher than the child support staff. It's a lot more, the professional staff are generally paid at a lower rate than the attorneys are, of course. I think that's probably your major reason.
That would have to be a significant, I mean, statistically huge. I haven't done the math yet, but just think about it in your head. Common sense tells you it might be something different besides that or in addition to that.
Chair Devlin, Representative Hanna, let me double check on that, and I'll send you over a further note of it.
Thanks.
The legal bases for the program are really spread through number of federal laws, primarily in the Social Security Act, as well as in various chapters of Oregon revised statutes. And then there are numerous, as indicated, a large number of Oregon families, probably 500,000 children, 250,000 families, and the district attorneys of Oregon, communities of interest in terms of this program. The impact of, again, not proposed reductions, but the alternative 10% budget reductions translate out into both reductions in the amount of recoveries for children and families, as well as into reductions in the recoveries for various state programs. If we go to the if you'll bear in mind that the program recovers money that supports the work of the Oregon Youth Authority in relation to children in their jurisdiction, under their jurisdiction, the foster care program, as well as the temporary aid to needy families program. Summing up, every dollar of general fund invested in this program, which pulls with it the matching 2-to-1 federal dollars, those state and federal dollars, but every state dollar produces about $6 of recoveries for families, children and families, as well as for the state programs that I mentioned. So it's one of the most highly leveraging investments that the legislature makes. And as Cindy Shinnock mentioned, the Oregon program is among the top 10 in the country in terms of that efficiency ratio of dollars recovered versus dollars invested. The third priority area we've called services to public safety that are general fund supported. Here we come to the first area of the department's budget where there is a reduction recommended in the governor's budget, a reduction of somewhat over $2 million. The program areas here are the defense of criminal convictions, and about $1.2 million of the governor's recommended reduction attaches to that program area. The other program area, district attorney assistance, organized crime in the criminal justice division, about $800 million of the governor's reductions attach in that overall program area.
Mr. Attorney General, in terms of the reduction... In terms of the reduction, the defense of criminal convictions, could you give us some idea of what that might mean in terms of what cases you would choose not to pursue, or would these be cases where you would not pursue extradition in a case, or?
Chair Devlin, I'm not aware of extradition being an identified area, although it's possible, but essentially what the reductions mean, even I think at the governor's level, means that we will be prioritizing by types of cases. We would develop a matrix which would prioritize types of appeals or collateral challenges, and we would have to make some decision about the extent to which we would be unable to appear for the state in particular cases. We would naturally try to manage as best we could to minimize that choice at the governor's recommended level, but I think we would face that to some extent.
Mr. Attorney General, if that happened, would a local district attorney have the capability to appear instead of the Attorney General's office?
Chair Devlin, I'm not sure whether under current law that would be possible. I'd have to check and respond to you on that.
Please proceed.
It would be, I might add, in regard to that, however, a significant, I think, resource issue for district attorney offices to appear even in an occasional case, given the tremendous strains that they are facing in just the first stage prosecutorial responsibilities they have. I think it's also worth noting that these program areas sustained cuts during the 2001-2003 rebalancing process ahead of the recommended reductions by the governor's budget. And then, of course, as we've noted, the alternative budget 10% reduction represents another nearly $2 million reduction in the two program areas. We're not the only agency charged, of course, with protection of Oregon communities. In fact, our role in the total scheme of Oregon law enforcement is relatively small, but as it happens, I think it's pretty important in these two program areas. We have the Center for the Collection of Criminal Intelligence. We have the services through district attorney assistance, particularly for rural communities. We have the work of the defense of criminal convictions, and we have the work in organized crime, which is centered on combating misconduct in public office, maintaining integrity in government in Oregon. Statutory mandate for this area of our activity is, again, in ORS Chapter 180, and the constituencies affected are local, state, and federal law enforcement, district attorneys, and the judiciary. The judiciary, in the sense that our ability to participate in the defense of criminal convictions is crucial to the full development of the issues in particular cases. And to the extent that's underdeveloped from the state side, it really falls upon the judiciary to try to develop the case issues in a way that the state would otherwise be doing.
Mr. Chair, is
yes.
This where...
Representative Wisner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is this where... the state is funding a district attorney per county, Doug, is this?
No, Mr. Chair, Representative Rosen, there is a separate budget that will appear called the district attorneys and their deputies, and that is where the 36 DAs are funded. This part of DOJ's is where they assist the DAs, where mostly in smaller or medium-sized counties that don't have a large office.
This program area, the DA Assistance Program, Chair Devlin, Representative Wisner, really represents a decision by the legislature to create a central pool of prosecution and investigation resources that can, in effect, help to equalize the resources across Oregon of the district attorneys, because so many of the counties, as I think Stephen Briggs mentioned, have very small DA offices. In some counties, there's only the DA. Or in some counties, there's the DA and one deputy. So a large case can quickly outrun the resources of that office.
Thank you, Mr.
Yes.
I'll follow up to that. I think it was this week that the counties, Association of Counties, was giving us a briefing, and they were showing a chart that showed like $160 for defense attorneys and $9 million for their local district attorneys. That's again, Doug, that's what we're going to see when we get to that. Is this part of that offsetting a bit unbalanced between what the defense attorneys get and what the district attorneys, the counties have to prosecute the cases?
Mr. Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm not sure, I've not seen the data that you saw, but in terms of the DA funding from the state, the DAs themselves are state employees and get paid, and there's another, I'm guessing, $700,000-$800,000 that flow out to the counties to help support DAs. But really, that state funding only represents probably between 85 and 90% of the total amount of DA funding. The bulk of it is paid out of county funds itself. So, I mean, I'm not sure if you're doing apples and oranges there in the comparison that the county association is saying. While the defense side, through the Public Defense Services Commission, is all state-funded.
Yeah, I'm trying to understand, because I try to pay attention. I remember that we were told by Department of Justice they help provide expert witnesses and they do all that, but the counties were saying that that's not true.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnett, the county or the state used to provide the district attorney's witness fees, but during 2001-03, during those cutbacks, that was one of the funding items that the state used to provide directly to DAs that got cut. I don't think the Department of Justice in their DA assist program provides any witness fees or any, you know, witnesses compensation in any way. They provide professional assistance to the local district attorneys and an expertise that they may not have.
Chair Devlin, that's correct. The assistance, to the extent it occurs, for witness fees, salary, supplements for deputy salaries, all of those are separate commitments of the legislature apart from the DA assist program in the Department of Justice, which is an investigation prosecution resource function.
Representative Wisnett, Mr. Attorney General, I think one thing that might be helpful, not today, but if Doug could sometime in the future provide, and I'll ask Senator Gourley about that, have an overview of the history of some of these issues, because there have been transfers of responsibilities for certain functions between the state and counties, and I would gladly take over the capital needs of courts if the counties would take back indigent defense. So maybe it would be a good idea for the committee to just get a brief overview sometime on how these services have basically been divided between the local and the state level. Representative Hansen.
Well, that would be helpful, because at this point in time, the state's only paying for, in the larger counties, the part of the district attorney salary, of a district attorney, and then I think part of the first deputy's salaries. In a county like Multnomah County, that means there's another 60 or 70 that the county is funding locally. In a small county that only has a district attorney or a district attorney and a deputy, is probably pretty helpful. But the larger it grows, and most of our counties are growing, it becomes less and less of a subsidy. And most of the time, they're enforcing state laws.
And in fairness to the district attorneys, I think the district attorneys have been fairly reasonable in that regard in terms of that fund for deputies, in the sense of recognizing the needs of smaller counties, and actually have actually generally steered the formula for it to benefit smaller counties. So, thank you. Mr. Attorney General.
Impact of proposed reductions, I've noted some already, centering on possible inability to defend certain criminal convictions, increased judicial branch workload, constricted ability to service the needs of district attorneys in the smaller counties when they request that help. Might mention, too, that in terms of a case backlog issue in the Defense of Criminal Convictions program, in the trial division component of that program alone, the current backlog, I can't recall if this was mentioned in the earlier presentation, is about 100 cases per lawyer now, compared to 50 cases in Washington State, 20 cases in California. So the backlog is a significant issue, a growing issue for us. Again, as also noted, constriction of the ability to prosecute corrupt public officials, getting legal advice to district attorneys themselves, which is a very important function of the lawyers in this the Criminal Justice Division, as well as the Appellate Division, and investigative support, particularly for complex cases. Priority four is what we are calling services to victims. And this area of the department centers on the work of the, on the one hand, of the Crime Victims Assistance Section, which includes the compensation program, the Child Abuse Multidisciplinary Intervention Program, or the CAMI program, as well as the Domestic and Sexual Violence Grant Program. And then, parallel to that, the work of the department in addressing civil law victims in the consumer protection, financial fraud consumer protection area. Here we come to another area of the budget in which there is a governor's recommended reduction, 10% reduction, of about $1.8 million. Now, of that, $1.6 million is the criminal fines and assessment account amount committed from the CFAA, the criminal fines and assessment account, to the support of the compensation program, to CANI, Child Abuse Multidisciplinary Intervention Program, and to the victim assistance programs in the DA's offices. $1.6 million of the total cut applies to those programs, and about $250,000 to the Domestic and Sexual Violence Grant Program, which is a separate general funded supported grant program administered by the Department of Justice. The governor, as also has been discussed, proposes not only the reduction in the criminal fines and assessment commitment, but also a shift of all of the CFA funds into the general fund. And I very much want to note the department's opposition to this change and our view that we ought to be moving in the opposite direction, which is to get back to a point in which the entire CFAA criminal fines and assessment account is a dedicated revenue source for various public safety programs. That was where we were not terribly long ago, and we have gradually moved away from that. This proposal would now completely eliminate any dedicated structural aspect of that program. On the consumer protection side, the legislature eliminated general fund support for that program in 2003. It is not proposed for restoration in the governor's budget, and any further reductions in terms of the authority to spend money from the revolving account will simply further reduce the services that are available.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Representative Woodson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Attorney General, I don't understand why the governor wants to put it in the general funds. Those people, it's a big cut. You know, those people have been talking to me. We have a center in Bend. And do you understand why the governor is wanting to put that money in, and how we're going to fund it if he takes it away from the general fund? Does he give us a direct line item for the money that's going in the general fund, or?
Sure, Devlin, Representative Wisnett, may I yield to the executive? First of all,
since the Attorney General doesn't support this either, maybe I better jump on the sword here. For the record, Kelly Frills with the Budget Management Division. The governor's thinking behind this is that programs that are financed by the CFAA or Criminal Fines and Assessment Account are essentially going to be prioritized against the same programs that are financed with the general fund. So it's an artificial distinction to assume that just because a program is financed with CFAA dollars that there's going to be some other prioritization that would be different and distinct from the general fund. The way the governor looked at these programs was to look at them as a discretionary pot of money that's available to finance programs, and he had prioritized accordingly. He did not make an artificial distinction between we have a certain amount of money for
the CFAA finance programs, and so we'll keep them separate and distinct from the general fund and decide how we're going to use those dollars, and then separate, as a separate conversation, look at all the programs that are financed with general fund and say, now we're going to prioritize these programs over here within the existing resources. He combined that conversation. He believes that's typically how these programs are, the decision on funding these programs are done, is to look at them as a separate and combined unit. So I'd be happy to answer any more questions you might have on this.
Does the chair have any clarification?
Yes, Representative Whitsnap. Do you need a clarification?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
I thought the chair maybe had one.
The only clarification I would have, Representative Wisnett, is there are people in the legislature that disagree with the decision of the governor to run the criminal fines and assessments through general funds. And one of them is this senator, and I think another one, I can't speak for him, but he has questioned it, is the co-chair on the Senate side. So.
Factors that drive prioritization of this area just are noted on this slide, but just note a couple of them. So far as the Victims Compensation Program, it's essentially critical funding for many victims. The state is the payer of last resort. But through the work of the different program areas, you're not only having compensation flowing to victims, but the Child Abuse Multidisciplinary Program Intervention Program is our key program with respect to the diagnosis and response to child sexual or other physical abuse. And then, of course, on the consumer side, we have the crucial role of that program in terms of being able to respond to unlawful conduct in the economy, which can, as I said in my initial presentation, I think amounts to various ways of stealing people's money from them. The department's services to victims activities are fitted in various chapters of Oregon revised statutes, and then in the federal law cited there, which is the Victims of Crime Act program, which flows significant money through the department and out to various nonprofit service providers for crime victims. Impact of the proposed reductions, restriction of the ability to pay compensation to victims, a weakening of the program directed toward diagnosing and responding to child abuse, and a weakening of the fabric of the services structure for victims, particularly through the DA's victim assistance programs and the nonprofit providers around the state. Priority 5 area is what we're calling services to public safety, which are other funds and federal funds driven or supported. They're on our priority list at this particular place on the list because they represent enhancements to the services that Oregon provides through its general fund or the other commitments that we were showing previously. For example, through the CFAA, Criminal Fines and Assessment Account. And they take various forms, some of which are set forth on the screen. The Internet Task Force involving Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force is one of the other items that's referenced there. So there's a variety of undertakings not involving general funds that act to extend the effect of the general fund commitments in the total area of public safety. But frankly, if these particular funds were not available for the particular purposes involved in the current budget climate, I'd be very hard-pressed to come before the subcommittee and say, I think you ought to replace them with general funds.
Yes. Thank you. Mr. Myers, could you briefly remind me where the $2.3 million in other funds are coming from?
Uh, 2.3, pardon me, Chair Devlin, Representative Hansen, which 2.3 are you referring to?
Okay, on the services to public safety, other funds and federal funds,
mm-hmm.
it's, the total is $3.4 million. It's split roughly $1 million for federal funds and $2.3 million for other funds. I'm just wondering where the other... Is that asset forfeiture or...
No, that's
I think Mr. Wilson has an answer.
Chair, for example, the high-intensity drug trafficking money comes to Oregon as federal funds, and a lot of this is the HIDA money, comes as federal funds to the state police, and it's sent over to DOJ.
Okay.
So that's why it's other funds here. It's federal funds in OSP's budget.
Okay.
And I think HIDA is probably a large share of this money.
Getting general nods behind
yeah.
Mr.
Yeah.
And if we didn't spend it, we wouldn't have it to spend anywhere else.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, I suppose if you didn't spend it in DOJ and the state had received the money, you could spend a greater share of it in the state police, for example, in some of the efforts around HIDA there. But as it stands now, it's a coordinated approach between DOJ and state police and local governments in large shares. So, and it is federal funds. It's not like a general fund where there's a whole reason to really reduce it.
Representative Wisman.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, that means it doesn't make sense to cut it because we're getting the money from the federal government anyway.
Yep.
Yeah.
It's no.
Our requirement in state statute didn't have to make sense.
Okay.
It just is a general requirement, so please proceed.
Various factors bearing on the prioritization of this area. These different funding, these different service undertakings serve multiple purposes involving some of which are shown there, but including, for example, the prosecution of child pornographers. Through the Internet Task Force, as well as training opportunities. Or as Chapter 180, again, is the really the basis for the legal basis for the footing for the department's activities in the particular areas in question. And the impacts of reductions, should they occur, really are in terms of the various forms of assistance, investigation, so forth, that take part within these program areas, and in effect, the turning away of federal funds. Priority six are what we call programs to protect or enhance state resources. These are the programs that protect or maximize state resources in one way or another. We're showing there the principal components of this overall area of the department. Of these, the one that is mandatory actually is the Medicaid Fraud Unit. That is one of the two programs recommended for reduction by the governor's budget. There is general fund in that program in a small amount, which is, however, matched 3-to-1 by federal funds. And the maintenance of the Medicaid Fraud Unit is a requirement of federal Medicaid law as a condition for participation in that overall program. The other area recommended for reduction in the governor's recommended budget is the Tobacco Tax Compliance Task Force. I'll comment on that in just a moment again, but in any event, as an overall matter, the key factors that support this particular priority are efforts to protect or enhance state resources in relation to potentially fraudulent activity or in terms of the, for example, the activities needed to enforce the non-participating manufacturer statute, which was discussed with you briefly in the first earlier presentation. I won't go into further detail now, but just to sum it up, though, the diligent enforcement of the statute dealing with non-participating manufacturers is a condition to the state's receipt of revenue under the National Tobacco Master Settlement Agreement. And so our failure to enforce the non-participating manufacturer statute diligently can reduce the state's share of the settlement revenue under the Master Settlement Agreement. So it's, in that sense, it's very much a income preservation program for the state. Various statutory provisions in ORS 180 and in 323, which is the Medicaid, which is the non-participating manufacturer statute, and then the Medicaid provisions of federal law. I mentioned that the Tobacco Tax Compliance Task Force was reduced in the governor's budget back to its 2001 level. Task Force was created in 2001 to seek to reduce evasion of Oregon's tobacco tax laws. Its resources were enhanced in 2003. The governor recommends taking them back to the level of 2001. We have just this past week filed a report of the three agencies that are part of the task force, Departments of Justice, State Police, and Revenue, analyzing options for recalibrating the state's response at a resource level which is higher than the 2001 level recommended by the governor, but less than the 2003 level approved by the last regular session. And this report is part of your materials that were submitted to you today. Final priority area deals with the department's work in the enforcement of our laws dealing with charitable corporations, charitable fundraising, and gaming by nonprofit organizations. There is no recommended reduction in this program area by the governor's budget. This is an entirely fee-supported area. There's no general fund involved, and the key factors that identify it as a priority within the department is its service in terms of trying to help inform charitable giving, to safeguard the proper operations of charitable corporations, and to ensure that charitable gaming activities are conducted properly in Oregon. Statutorily rests on chapters 128 and 180, with the community served nonprofit organizations and the community of charitable donors in Oregon. Impact of reductions would be reduced information for charitable donors, reduced ability to oversee the operations of charitable corporations to principal ones, as well as constriction in the regulation of charitable gaming. These are programs that the Assembly has assigned the Department of Justice because it thought they were, and I think rightly, thought that were an important area of oversight of certain aspects of life in our state. I think that if the Assembly were to decide that it wanted to reduce the resources permitted the Department to be raised and spent for these areas, it really amounts to a reassessment on your part of the importance of these program areas. Otherwise, there's no general fund implications at all. To conclude, Chair Devlin, members, what I've just reviewed for you represents our good faith effort to capture for you the primary functions in respect to the rule of law of the Department of Justice and to arrive at a first prioritization of them for you. We, of course, look forward to the opportunity to work as helpfully as we can with you as you work through to your ultimate decisions about prioritization and the resource levels for these particular program areas.
Thank you very much, Mr. Attorney General. Final questions for the Attorney General. Representative Hannah.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Attorney General, I didn't quite understand what you said about there being no implication to general fund dollars right at the end there.
In the final program area, excuse me, Chair Devlin.
On the final.
Of the charitable-related activities.
Okay. I thought you were talking about all of that.
$36
million.
Chair Devlin, Representative Hannah, I certainly wish I could tell you that.
Any additional questions for the Attorney General?
Well, thank you very much for coming. I know Senator Gourley would actually like to be here, but it's ill this afternoon, and Senator Winters had another commitment. I think Doug has one thing he'd like to bring up.
Just a couple things. On the prioritized list, this long form, what the co-chairs have asked the department to do, and I've talked to them a little bit, is if you'll notice on the first two pages, which are the agency-wide sort of prioritization, there are no sort of subcategories under each of those that are more detailed in the pages in the back. What the co-chairs would like them to do before these are discussed more formally in mid-March is to come back and sort of rank all of those agency-wide, rank all the subcategories. So staff will work with them now, in between now and then, on that, and come back. They'll come back with a new prioritization sheet. The other thing is we passed out a folder where the Attorney General mentioned the tobacco tax enforcement report. There are some responses to some of the questions you've asked during last week's hearings that are included in here, some other information. We will be getting other responses to you as they come in and hand them out to you in terms of questions that you've had to the department, which they did not have the information at the time to give you.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
One question I'd like to have answered when we get into phase two. Of the $99 million other fund that basically supports the general government portion of your activities, I'd like to see how that would be broken down in terms of whether those dollars originate from general fund, from federal funds, or other funds. Kind of what the percentage?
40%, roughly.
Representative Hammond.
Thank you. Doug, I'd like to also, as we get to the more detailed level, when we come to the FTE reductions, could we get job classifications or any further breakdown? Because some of those we look at it, and you know, like the one section, it seems like an exorbitant amount of money for the total FTEs, but then it's less the payments to victims and so forth. So for us to have a good understanding, I'd like to break that into a little more detail.
Okay. Anything additional? Thank you very much, Mr. Attorney General. Could Craig Prince come forward? Well, Mr. Prince is coming forward. I didn't tell him that I would try to embarrass him, but I'm not trying to do that. And not Mr. Prince. But I have a constituent in the back of the room, Steve Molmans, who's from my district. And it's kind of a rare occurrence. Often we have high school students that come or middle school students. Obviously, Mr. Molmans is well beyond those years and quite a bit younger than Representative Hansen and myself. But he's actually here just to observe the legislature and just wanted to see what we do.
Great.
So,
welcome.
Mr. Prince.
Are we going to transfer the embarrassment?
Mr. Chair, let me set out the stage here a little bit. Senator Gourley had wondered if some of the folks on the subcommittee would like a background in sort of the sentencing process and mostly the sentencing guidelines before one moves into the Department of Corrections, because this is one of those things that drives the Corrections Department. So there are two presentations before we get to the Department of Corrections, the first being Mr. Prinz, who's the Executive Director of the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission, giving you some background on sentencing guidelines. There's a couple things in front of you, one of which I'm passing out down your way right now, which is his presentation and quite a bit of background material. And then at your seat, you should have this grid, this two-page laminated grid, which is really the backbone of the sentencing guideline system, which I'm sure Craig will refer to. As a plug, the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyer Association was kind enough to give you a copy of this free. They usually charge for it, but they were nice enough to give you one free today. So, it is really the backbone of what the sentences are. It outlines Measure 11 and then the non-Measure 11 crimes and what the sentences and how they're determined. And I think Craig will do a good job in terms of outlining that for you.
As a lawyer fees, we may have to report this, right?
Representative Wisnant, I'm not sure about that. I am sure about one thing. If you understand this after one brief presentation,
you should be aware.
Then Mr. Prince will have done an outstanding job.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll try to channel my inner professor is what I do on these. And I'll go over kind of a big picture. And, Doug, thank you for saying that if there is a lobbying thing to make it worth, the criminal defense attorneys, not me, who gave you these. But honestly, these are very hard to come by, so keep a hold of it, because this is the most recent that I've seen up-to-date guideline grid. And so this is what all the DAs, defense attorneys, and judges will have in the courtroom with them as they're resolving cases, felony cases. And so it is really the way to kind of walk through these things. Doug, should I move this back if it's kind of, am I too close? Is that the problem? Okay. Mr. Chair, if I can, I gave you a handout, and instead of going through that, I just want to mention the highlights and then really just walk you through the grid block, because it's actually easier to see how this works visually than try to go over through my testimony. But what I did, and I did want to point out, is what are the sentencing guidelines? They are just administrative rules, just like any other agency or commission has. Ours are different than others in that we, first of all, the commission was started in 95. The guidelines go back to 1989. So if you're thinking of this kind of with a historical perspective, and I put this historical perspective in your paperwork if you want it, but the historical perspective and the big picture is, in Oregon, we have moved from what you would call indeterminate sentencing, where you would look at the maximum sentence, which for any C felony would be a maximum sentence of 5 years. In the old days, you would have the Board of Parole, and I don't know if Mr. Washington has spoken to you yet, but Michael, okay. So the Board of Parole in the old days, before the guidelines, a defendant would be sentenced, and the sentence would say something like up to 5 years. And then the Board of Parole would have most of the discretion or would make the decisions about when that person should, how much prison time that person should be sentenced to, and then when they should be released on parole. And in Oregon, what that system brought about was a system where really what decided how long you stayed in prison was economics. I mean, it always is economics, but what happened is you had then a parole matrix, so that fellows would get sent to prison and then would get matrixed out, much like you would hear from, say, your local sheriff and your local constituency when they say, well, we're matrixing. That's really what happened at the prison as well. So if you look at this as a historical process of how we came to have the grid and the guidelines, and actually the Attorney General was, I think, a big part of this, and so I was going to make that point, but he's not, I don't think, here anymore. But what the grid does and what the guidelines do is, rather than have that you're sentenced to up to 5 years and then sorted out with the Board of Parole, what this did is it tried to have the judge in court at the time of sentencing set what the sentence would be. So everyone had a better idea, and there was more truth. It's kind of a truth in sentencing type thing, part of that movement in the late 80s. And so that was the goal of this grid. I highlighted that goal. So you'd have proportional punishment so that you'd have crimes of the same seriousness would be treated the same. They'd be treated the same in every county because this is statewide. And you really have uniformity, and you'd be able to then maintain the prison population because you would have the commission look at the population and decide where a crime should be on this grid. So that's the background. That was how we got here. And incidentally, if you have any questions, just interrupt and ask them of me, and I'll be happy to answer them with the chair's permission. So here's how you use the grid. Doug wanted me to touch on the Blakely case, too, if you've heard about the Blakely case and how that would affect the gridlock. But here's the big picture. You've got 1 through 11, crime seriousness, right? So the least serious crimes are ones that would be like possession of a controlled substance. So like, say, a meth user who possesses a little bit of meth, a small amount of meth, would be a level 1. Incidentally, you know, and you can see on here where, if you have a crime you're interested in, maybe you're thinking of committing a crime, wanting to know what the presumptive sentence would be, you can see they're all listed here. But the idea is least serious to the most serious. Then you have this line this way, and I is the, this I, A through I, is the defendant's criminal history. And so that's how these this system works. You look at the seriousness of the crime, and you look at the defendant's criminal history, and then you look at then where that intersection would be. That box is what's called the presumptive sentence. Okay? So that's how this is set up. Incidentally, to compare that to the... This is not a system based upon rehabilitation. This is more a system based upon appropriate punishment for the crime seriousness and the criminal history. Of course, I say that, and then a caveat would be, I think most people would say a person's criminal history will kind of tell you how they're going to do this time, and so they're treated more seriously if they're a repeat offender. So, say you have a... I don't know, does anyone have a crime they want to find on here and I can go through it? If you're not, I'll just pick one. Mr. Chair, looks like you almost...
let's see. Let's just do an assault one.
Okay, assault one. That's a good one to give the example because... Obviously, since 1989, when the guidelines went in, we've had several statutory sentencing measures. Specifically, we've got Measure 11, and Assault 1 is a Measure 11 crime. You've got repeat property offenders, and that changes the presumptive sentence. And again, we'll talk about what presumptive sentence means and how that would change with certain factors. Those two statutory sentencing pieces, you have to think of those not as separate from the guidelines, but kind of superimposed on top of the guidelines. So, and Sue will tell you about how that relates to the prison population. So, if you look at assault in the first degree, assault in the first degree would be assault with a deadly weapon. And as I recall, assault with a deadly weapon which causes serious physical injury. All crimes kind of basically go, you have this for the guidelines, all crimes basically work like this. You have the level of injury, whether there was a risk of injury, whether it was actual injury, whether there was death. Obviously those become more serious. And then you often look at what's called the state of mind of the defendant. Was the defendant acting with no intent to do anything? Was he acting negligently? Was he acting recklessly? Was he acting knowingly or intentionally? So I say that to say assault one, as far as assaults go, is the most serious because it deals with a deadly weapon and it's a serious physical injury. So to find out what the way you would use the grid for that is you would look down here, it says crime seriousness, and it has assault one here, and it gives you the ORS subsection 164325. And it says, see the Measure 11 table, which is right here in the corner. For Measure 11 crimes, they still have what we call a crime category, but Measure 11 sets the minimum sentence for that crime. So, really, for Assault 1, the minimum sentence is 90 months prison. Do you see where that is in the corner? Now, if you look at the crime seriousness, it's either a 9 or a 10, depending on certain factors about the victim, as I recall. If you look on the back of here, you'll have the crime categories serious. If you look on the back and you'll see assault 1, is a 10 if the victim did not substantially contribute to the commission of the offense by precipitating the crime. So you would find then that assault would be up here 10. It's the second to the highest, murder being the highest. And then if it were not a if it is a measure 11 or not, you would find the defendant's criminal history, which in court you're going to have certified convictions and you're going to have their the list of their felonies. Say that this was a first offender. Say this was the first offense. So you would say, well, a first offense on the lateral grid is an I, because an I is something that's no juvenile felonies or adult A misdemeanors. So for assault 1, if a person has no criminal history, their crime category is a 10, and their criminal history is an I, so you'd get to this box right here. And prior to measure 11, this would have been the presumptive sentence, 58 to 60 months in prison. So that would be the guidelines. However, measure 11 superimposes on that. And so it would actually be, the judge would have to sentence them to at least 90 months. So that's how you'd find any crime like that.
Conversely, though, if the person had a lengthy criminal history, they would receive a heavier sentence than that.
Correct. If the person had, say, you're exactly right, Sam, that if they did have a bad criminal history, if you look at someone who has two person felony priors, and incidentally, the commission also categorizes every crime as either a person or non-person crime, and then we take that information out and it fits into the grid. So yes, if someone had two prior person felonies and they committed an assault one, their actual presumptive sentence would be greater than the minimum under Measure 11. So that's how you find a crime on there. I want to highlight a couple things about this. One, you'll see there's the yellow part, and there's a dark line that separates the yellow from the, what is that, blue and purple. That is the dispositional line. So all that means is the things above the line, the presumptive sentence is prison. The things below the line, the presumptive sentence is probation. And to interpret these numbers, have I lost you all yet? Good, okay. How am I doing as a professor so far? Bored? Okay. Don't yawn. Okay, so for the ones below the line, how you would determine that, the guidelines say that the presumptive sentence on that is that that person does not go to prison. That person goes on probation. And then what you would do is you'd look on this side here that says P-R-O-B term. That's the presumptive probation term. So, say for, to give you another example of a crime that a lot of people are concerned about with meth and things is property crimes, like identity theft, okay? Because that's below, so identity theft, because I remember this, is below the dispositional line, and the presumptive sentence is probation. So if you look it up and you find it on here alphabetically, it says identity theft. It says property. And for identity thefts, you actually have to turn this thing over. And an identity theft is based upon the value of the what was stolen. I can tell you for identity theft, it's a 2 because there's not a monetary value for what your identity is. It's very valuable, but it's not like normal property crime. So identity theft is typically a level 2 crime. Okay? So what that would mean is, you would find the crime category is level 2, and then you would find your defendant's criminal history, and you'd see two numbers there that say 90 and 30. Do you see that? It says that? And incidentally, it says that no matter what their criminal history is. Okay? The way you would read this is you'd say, okay, I know that this is below the line, so it's a probation sentence. And you can see that the presumptive probation term is 18 months. So that they're going to be on for 18 months. And what that block means is that means when a probation officer, when you have a probation sentence, you can still sentence to that person to some jail time at the beginning. So that tells you how much you could use 30 days jail as part of the sentence, and then those the other number, the 90 and 30, that represents how many sanction units can be used. So say say a guy gets on probation on the identity theft, he doesn't do too well, and he has to have a sanction. His probation officer can give him that sanction and say, okay, you need to go to the day reporting center, or you need to go to jail for a few days. That those numbers represent the maximum amount of that. And it's more technical and complicated than that, but that's what those numbers mean in the cases that are in the probation, under the probation line. So the way you'd read this then is, as you can see, the probation term, as you go, 5 years for the most serious is the probation term, 3 years for the, you know, less two, and then goes down to 18 months. The next portion, you can see where it talks about an upward dispositional departure. Do you see that if you read across? That's the next thing that you should probably, I want to tell you about the sentencing guidelines, and you're going to hear a lot about the Blakely case. The Blakely case is a United States constitutional case that deals with a question of who makes... Let me back up. I'm sorry. In the United States Constitution, there is a right to a jury trial found in the Sixth Amendment. And historically, how the guidelines have been presented, you would find the presumptive sentence, but in special cases, you can, the lawyers will argue to the judge, this is how it happened, has happened in the past, the lawyers will argue to the judge that he should depart up, he should give him a more severe sentence or a less severe sentence. And they argue about the basis of those, they call them aggravating factors and mitigating factors. And on the back of your thing, you'll see here where it says departure sentences. Do you see that? Okay, so these are typical departure sentences. You can see here they have mitigating ones that would, so the defense attorney would say, well, Your Honor, yes, the presumptive sentence is 19 months prison, but I'd like you to find a mitigating factor that, for example, the victim was the aggressor. And then the DA is going to be arguing for aggravating factors. This is, obviously, in 90% of cases, they agree on this, and you get a plea. You plead this out and you make this all a plea disposition and you resolve this by agreement. But in some cases there would be an argument about whether there are or not. The Blakely case, all it really stands for in relation to our guidelines is that under our guidelines, the way they work, that decision about whether there is an aggravating or a mitigating factor present should be decided by the jury. That's part of your jury right. So a judge would not decide that, the jury would. So you'll hear a lot about Blakely, and that's a shorthand version for what it means. It would deal with aggravating and mitigating factors. Let's see. Then, just to highlight a couple other things, if you say someone did a crime that there were aggravating factors, the judge then, well, this is pre-Blakely, so let's usually, like I said, I was a DA for a few years, and most cases we resolve these things, we argue back and forth, you never talk to a judge, and then you agree to a sentence, and that's normally what you would do, is you'd have an agreement that you'd say, okay, we're going to agree that there are aggravating factors, and the judge would find substantial and compelling reasons. That's the language that it's, the way we couch that is there are substantial and compelling reasons to have an aggravated sentence, a more serious sentence. The maximum you can do is governed by, if you go right, you've got the grid and then the probation terms, and then you have the maximum dispositional departure. What that means is, if it's a presumptive probation sentence, this here, where it says 18 months, that's the maximum you could get of prison. So if someone was successful in saying, wow, this was a really bad case, this was worse than usual. That's the highest they can go. Do you see what I'm... So it'd be 18 months, 6 months on the lower level. For the prison sentences, the maximum is generally twice the box. That's the maximum you could depart. So, and departures happen rarely. I would say it's less than 10% of the cases. And of those 10%, I would say most of those are by agreement of the two parties, meaning you both know it's the type of case where the judge would depart and the DA wants to save time and not go to trial. The defense attorney is going to give him a little bit better deal than he thinks he would get at trial, and they try to resolve it. So that's... Do you have any questions about how to kind of walk around the grid? I can try to answer for you. Or is there anything else on your mind?
I think the only thing is just a comment is that having worked in the adult correctional system prior to this and leaving just about the time a few years before this came into effect, I think what we saw back then was that, and I know that there are people that will argue for discretion in terms of judicial decisions, but we saw great disparity in judicial decisions, particularly dependent upon where the area was. And as people know, humor inside adult facilities is not sometimes politically correct. And you would see that, people that, if you were not of minority status and you were middle class and you had a job and you'd been married for a number of years, you would have to get very high up this scale to actually see any time at all.
Mm-hmm.
If you were poor and of a minority race, you might get very high up this just based on factors that probably shouldn't have been considered but were considered in terms of just general feelings about persons' future criminal activity. The other thing was that I think part of this came about because we had not really built any significant correctional facilities since 1959 at that time. And although we'd built some small release centers and things of that nature, just about the time I left is when they were in the process of converting the mental facility at Pendleton to additional beds, and that was during former Director Frankie's time.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the reason for that was we literally had no sanctions left in the system. Person that violated parole might be brought back, but they wouldn't be kept any period of time. So I think generally the sentencing guidelines have been pretty well received.
And so if I can, to kind of dovetail that, on the handout I gave you, if you look on page 15, this will show you what the average time before and after the guidelines was served. I think that that's true historically. If you look at the 80s, and I think there were several measures that were not passed by the levies to build more prisons that were not carried by the voters, and that's true. There was overcrowding problems, and what you had is most of the prison population was actually revoked parolees. They'd been out, revoked, and came back. It's in here somewhere what number it was. But if you look at this, if you look at the crime group, you can see how even before, this is before Measure 11, how much the crime, how much the sentences changed for your serious crimes like assault, and specifically for, look at homicide. In 1986, the average sentence was 34. In 1994, it was 157 months. So it did really change even prior to Measure 11, and then obviously Measure 11 changed it substantially more. The other thing I wanted to... there's one thing that I always want to point out when we're talking about the guidelines is... if you can turn to page 9 of my handout, one of the things that I think we can all be, I mean, a direction we've gone in Oregon is that we do not have as I was telling you, possession of a controlled substance, unless it's a substantial quantity, is a crime category one, which if you look at who goes to prison, really in Oregon you don't go to prison if you're just possessing a drug. If you're a user amount of drug, those don't go to prison. Those are on probation, and we try to do treatment in this state. I think there's a lot of I don't know if that was what your preconceived notion was, but I run into a lot of people that think that our prisons are full of drug possessors. They're full of probably people who have a drug problem, but they're then people that have committed more serious crimes than that, than just what I what you know, just the possession itself. And so I have my staff kind of, you can see what they do with, we get reports from the courts on whenever there's a sentence, the courts give us a report and let us know what the sentence was. And you can see through here, you have statistics on how many of those that are sentenced are actually first-time offenders for the different types of crimes. And DOC has all these two. And what you'll see is really the sentencing guidelines, that the vast majority of the cases are going to be drug-related, either possession, delivery, or manufacture of drugs, or they're going to be property crimes. And then you'll find that Measure 11 is going to deal with the more of the person crimes, or the sexual offenses. Mr. Chair, if there's any, I mean, I know I'd be happy to answer any questions. I know the forecast is very interesting too.
Mr. Prinz, I think Doug could help this. Mr. Wilson could help people with this too. But you would be available if any members
anytime
want to go over the sentencing guidelines.
Absolutely, and I will. And I also help legislative fiscal determine the fiscal impact of the different legislative measures, so I'll be doing that on all the measures that come through that relate to felony crimes. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. The next person on our agenda is Susan Porter.
Mr. Chair, I just handed you the committee members a packet of materials which she will be using for hers. It's under the table. The other thing that's in front of you, hopefully somewhere in your file, is something that looks like this, which includes the directions to Coffee Creek. Tomorrow's hearing is up there. Before we close, you should talk about this for 30 seconds.
And I think the committee can anticipate, and I think the director, Max Williams, knows that we'll probably be doing his overview tomorrow. Please proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Suzanne Porter. I'm with the Office of Economic Analysis. And I'm here today to tell you about historical and forecast correctional populations. Our office does semi-annual forecasts of the adult correctional populations, including prison and community corrections. And we also do a semi-annual forecast of the demand for closed custody youth authority beds. Briefly on how we do this, we have what's called a flow model, and what that does is it tries to mimic the criminal justice system and how offenders flow through the system from arrest to prosecution to the disposition, which would be probation or prison, the time they serve there, their release, and then some would be revoked. For example, since the system is interconnected, our model is interconnected, so when people get out of prison, they automatically go to the post-prison supervision caseload. Some people will fail that, and they will go back to either local control or to prison. So that's the way that our model works. It's built on an extract of the Department of Corrections correctional information systems, actual records of felony offenders going back to July 1991, and that's people on probation, post-prison, prison, all of them. And I brought along our forecast, the adult correctional forecast I'm talking about today is our October 2004. Right now we're working on a new forecast that will be out in about the third week of March, and that traditionally is the one that is used to build the Department of Corrections budget. I was also asked to bring along the Youth Authority closed custody demand forecast. That's a little different since the Youth Authority beds are, the number of beds is dependent on the funding levels. We have changed how we do this forecast. We now forecast what the demand for beds is. The adult correctional forecast is what the population will be, not the demand for it. So starting with prison, Oregon's prison population has grown almost 85% in the last 10 years. That's going from January 1995 to January of this year. We forecast that it will increase by 37% over the next decade. So that would take us from about 6,900 offenders in 1995 to almost 13,000 today to about 17,500 in July of 2014. In my testimony on page one at the bottom is a chart that shows the historical and forecast prison population, and along the way there's some notes that talk about new laws that were passed and when they went into effect. So this particular chart starts January 1995, right after that Measure 11 took effect. And the population grew for a while, and then in the beginning, about the first 6 months of 1997, the population went down for a while. That's when the Community Corrections Act, or also known as Senate Bill 1145, or local control, went into effect. That law took felons who were sentenced to 12 or fewer months, took them out of the prison system, and put them into the community correction system. So during the 6 months that transition was taking place, prison population fell. In the summer of 97, the repeat property offender law went into effect. Now, if you looked at Craig's guidelines, you could see that people who did nothing but property crimes, say thefts, over and over again, if you only had property crimes, you would never elevate yourself to the point on the guidelines where you would go to prison. So this new law is, again, superimposed on the guidelines. If you have committed a certain property crime and you have a certain criminal history, you get either a 13 or 19-month sentence. That puts you in prison. Since that law went into effect, and it's been revisited and had things added to it along the way, but the prison population has had uninterrupted growth since then until July of last year. We've gone through a period now where the prison population has been flat. It's the first time since 1997 that the prison population has not grown over a six-month period, and that is due to this new alternative incarceration program that was passed in the last legislative session that allows some offenders to earn time, extra time off their sentence by going through an intensive drug program. You would hear more about that from Department of Corrections. But that has brought some time in growth, and we expect that growth will continue starting around the late spring of this year. We will be back into growth mode. All the effect that we can get from the alternative incarceration program will be absorbed. On page two, we show biennial growth, and you can see that the growth by biennium has started to slow, starting with the 0103 biennium, both in terms of percent growth and the number of offenders. And that will continue throughout our forecast 10-year period. We have 10.9% growth for this biennium. I think with the alternative incarceration program, probably will be close to 9% for the biennium when we get to July of this year. Historically, we have estimated that about 60% of the growth that occurred between July 95 and July 2004 was the direct or indirect effect of Measure 11. And we estimate that Measure 11 will contribute 43% of the growth forecast between July 04 and July 2014. Now, we estimate that 15% of the growth between July 98 and July 2004 was due to the repeat poverty offender laws, and that an additional 8% of growth over the next decade will come from those laws. The other significant growth, source of growth in the past has been in the number of offenders that have a sentence ranging from 12 months and one day to 15 months. If we went back to July 1 of 96, before local control went into effect, there were 50 offenders in prison that had a sentence like that. As of July of last year, there were 380 offenders like that, and this does not include repeat property offenders. And we believe that is a response to the local control sentence, where before it didn't matter what your sentence was. If you had a felony sentence, you went to prison. We think these people probably were getting a 10 to 12 month sentence back then. Now you have to have more than that to get to prison. So they are just sentenced to slightly over that mark. Vast majority have a 13 month sentence that puts them into prison instead of in community corrections.
On that light, Ms. Porter, one of the few newspapers that publishes sentences is the local paper here, the Statesman Journal. And I have noticed quite a number of 13 and 15 month sentences in recent months.
Table 2 at the bottom of page 2 is snapshots of the prison population at three points in time: July 96, last July, and July of 2014. And these are characteristics we look at when we're forecasting. We're looking at, ultimately, we're looking at the custody level and the gender, because this is going into a corrections construction plan. But I'm sure there are other characteristics that are more interesting to you. So I brought along these snapshots. These are from the Department of Corrections. They're on their website every month, right after the first of the month. These will be posted. The one for prisons for February 1st, and it shows the prison population that day according to all kinds of much more interesting characteristics, like substance abuse, need, mental health, education, so on, as well as more detail on the crime. And there's another one that's for the community correction population. It takes longer to compile that, so that just came out October 1st of last year. That's the latest data. And it shows, you know, if they're on same type of characteristics, but whether they're on probation, post-prison supervision, and also what county. So those are out every month, and I brought those along because I show these snapshots I have, and people will ultimately ask how many have a drug need, and we don't do that, but it is available. If we compare the population last July compared with July 96, we had fewer people, smaller percentage of people serving for a revocation. That's due to that Community Corrections Act, local control. Most of the time when people are revoked, that sentence would be under 12 months. So those people are out in the county now. We have a higher percentage of females, a higher percentage of people serving a Measure 11 sentence, and a higher percentage of offenders that are age 50 or over. We expect these trends to continue over the next 10 years, so that by the time we get to July 1, 2014, we would have an even smaller percentage of revocations, higher percentage of females, higher percentage of people serving a mandatory minimum sentence under Measure 11, and a higher percentage of older inmates. Since Measure 11 is the single biggest driver behind prison growth, I've brought a little more detail on how that has happened. And it's not because more people are coming to prison. It's the difference in sentence between the people that come to prison now as opposed to prior to the law. When I say Measure 11 sentence, I mean someone who is sentenced to the mandatory minimum in Oregon Revised Statute 137700. When I say Measure 11 crime, I'm talking about someone who went to prison for the same crime, same conviction, but it predates Measure 11. So they're going to be sentenced under the guidelines or even before that under the old parole system. And then finally, there's Measure 11 related. That group of people, they're convicted of the same type of crime as appear in Measure 11, but they're one degree removed. So, for example, Assault 1 is a Measure 11 crime. Attempted Assault 1 is not. Assault 3 is not. Now, there's been a lot of growth in people coming to prison with those kind of convictions since Measure 11 took effect. Hardly anyone went to prison for, say, Assault 3 prior to Measure 11. Now it's common. So we consider those to be Measure 11 related. This also includes, there's another statute, 137712, that allows some exceptions to Measure 11. So all those people together are Measure 11 related. Now on page 3 of my testimony, there is a table 3. It shows intakes to the Department of Corrections for Measure 11 crimes and Measure 11 sentences over the years. And the box there between 1995 and 96 fiscal years is when Measure 11 took effect. You can see as the law went into effect, we did not get more people coming to prison with those crimes. In fact, we got fewer. Yet the prison population grew, and that is shown on page 4. There is a chart that shows the length of stay for Measure 11 sentenced offenders and offenders with Measure 11 crimes coming to prison before the law took effect. The top line shows on the vertical axis you have the percentage of people remaining in prison, and the horizontal line is the number of months after they were admitted. So if you look at that 50% line, the midpoint, and go across to the top, that Measure 11 sentenced individuals, you will see that the midpoint is 89 months. So after 89 months, half the people are gone, they've been released, half are still there. At the end of 10 years, which is how long our forecasts go, over 30% are still serving a prison sentence. Now, the lower line, the people that are went to prison for the same crimes but before Measure 11, the midpoint there is about 37 months. So on the whole, you know, these two groups of offenders, there's a 50-month difference in the length of time they stay. Not every offender, but just as a whole. That's what's caused most of the growth from Measure 11. Down at the bottom of that same page, this is our estimated impact of Measure 11 on the prison system that we do with every forecast. It consists of indirect impact and direct impact. Direct impact is just what I told you about just now, that difference in the length of stay. Indirect impact is from those Measure 11 related people, the people with, say, attempted assault 1 or robbery 3. There's been just going on memory, probably about a 4-fold increase in the number of people going to prison with those kind of crimes. So they may initially have been charged with Measure 11 but were convicted of something less. They're going to prison, and they have about 22-month average length of stay. Now, that part of the impact grew rapidly at the beginning, but now it's as big as it's going to get. There's about 1,000 offenders. So the future growth now is coming from people with actual Measure 11 sentence and just the longer length of stay that they're spending. Another area of concern, I think, to the Department of Corrections is female inmates. The number of female inmates has nearly doubled since 1996. We forecast it to grow by another 40% between now and July 2014. Table 4 on page 5, there's another snapshot, same 3 points in time, and we're looking at the types of crime that for which female inmates were sent to prison. You could see that there's been a lot of growth in property crimes, and behavioral crimes, which are mostly going to be drug-related. Identity theft, in particular, has been a driver of the female prison population. And we looked at felony sentencing guidelines reports, the thing that Craig's organization gets from the courts. We looked at those for the years 2001 and 2002, and we found that half of all offenders that were convicted of identity theft were females. There are very few felony crimes that have a participation rate like that for females. Community corrections is the other part of our forecasting that we do. We've been doing that since April of 2000. There's a chart at the bottom of page 5 that shows the overall community corrections caseload. That's the shaded area going back to January 2000. There's been some changes over the years as a definition of what is the funded caseload, and that's what we forecast, the funded caseload. So that's why our data go back only 5 years, because those definitions have changed. The line on the chart is just the parole and post-prison supervision component of the total caseload. Between January 2000 and March of 2003, the overall caseload grew just slightly. Then, as you'll see in the chart, between February of 2003 and October of 2003, the caseload dropped pretty dramatically by over 1,000 cases. That came from, if you will recall, the courts initiated a cost-saving measure, and one of the things that they did is well, they deferred less serious crimes, and some of the crimes that fell in that category were C felonies. And most of the people that go to probation are convicted of a C felony. So that, it's like a, if you will, a kink in the hose. People were not being sentenced to probation for that period. It caused the caseload to drop. Now, since that time, the probation caseload has only come up just a couple hundred cases after dropping by 1,000. But the overall caseload now is starting to recover, and that's all from parole and post-prison supervision. That group of people is growing. In fact, it used to be, before the kink in the house, about 60% of the overall caseload was probation, 35% was parole and post, and 5% was local control. Now, with that probation cases going away and more post-prison, now 40% of the caseload is post-prison supervision, and the probation portion has gone down by 5%.
Just so clarification so the committee understands, that kink that you talk about, you're referring to the period of time, I believe it would be probably around February, March 2003 until the start of the next biennium, when we ran very short of dollars for courts and we ran very short of dollars for indigent defense.
Yes, Mr. Chair, that's exactly right.
Put off prosecution of lesser cases, and I think some of my district attorneys called it sort of a let's make a deal after July 1st and tried to clear their dockets of the, in some cases, of the at least a couple thousands of cases in one county that had built up during that time.
Yes, Mr. Sharon, now we'll talk about, we thought that those cases would come back, that they would be deferred and eventually be disposed, but they just kind of disappeared as far as, you know, the way we were able to track them. Growth in the post-prison supervision caseload, that's what's driving the whole caseload to come back up. And it's both for more people coming out of prison and a slightly longer length of supervision. That's what's driving that. As far as forecast performance, how good are these forecasts? Traditionally, our April forecast in an odd number year is, you know, goes into the information that you will use to budget for the Department of Corrections. So how reliable it is it? on page 6, table 5, it's talking about prison population. I've got 8 forecasts going back 8 years, and so far 6 of the 8 are accurate within 2%. For the April odd number year forecast, the critical period of time that deals with the budget is from 6 to 3 months. So our forecast we're working on right now is going to start with January 1st of this year. By the time the biennium starts, it's already 6 months old, and it's got to carry through 30 months. It's got to be, you know, it should be accurate all the time, but that's the most critical period. So the last column there on table 5 shows the accuracy at 6 to 30 months. 4 of those 6 have stayed within 1.5%, and half of them have stayed within 1% of the actual population. And 3 of the 4 forecasts actually used in a budget stayed within 1% during that critical period. I also brought along, we put out these tracking reports for each forecast. This particular one talks a lot about the October forecast, but on page 4 of it, that talks about the April 03 forecast that went into making the last budget, so you can see how that tracked. The prison forecast is doing well on that side. With community corrections, table 6 talks about that. Because of the time lag, that forecast has to be accurate from 9 to 33 months. The forecast we're working on right now starts with October 1, 2004. By the time the new biennium starts, it's 9 months old. It's got to go out 33 months. And that column, you can see 2 of the 3 are within 2%. Our current forecast for community corrections at the moment is running 3.5% high for the biennium. It is getting closer, but what that is, so we were able to predict those cases that went away. We were able to predict they're going away pretty well. It was the coming back that we missed on. So the forecast and the actual are starting to converge now, but it's been a long time coming.
Ms. Porter, we're going to finish up here in about...
Okay. I'm at the last thing I wanted to talk about is risks to the forecast. For the prison population forecast, the risk, the biggest risk is a change in law. Anything that's going to elevate something from a felony to a misdemeanor or take something from a felony down to a misdemeanor, anything that makes prison sentences longer is going to affect the prison population commensurate with the number of people it affects and how big the change is per sentence. It's a big multiplication problem. Number of people, how long they stay. Now, changes in law enforcement out in the community, it can have some effect, but it's going to be muted and it's going to be gradual. On the community correction side, we have the same risks. In addition, there's much more discretion about who gets supervised, how long, and so on. And even with that, constraints in other parts of the system, like we saw in 2003, can make a dramatic effect on that. And thank you for inviting me, and I will try to answer any questions that you might have.
Any questions from the committee? Hearing none right now.
Thank you.
We will. Anything additional for the good of the order?
Mr. Chair, just yes. A reminder for tomorrow, the meeting in Wilsonville will start around 1 o'clock, according to the chair. I point out the directions here. Please bring your the notebooks we delivered to you on Thursday, the Department of Corrections presentation. We'll be spending a couple hours with the director of Department of Corrections going through that. There'll be a tour of the facility after that. I encourage you to wear somewhat comfortable shoes because you're walking on concrete and you'll probably be doing quite a bit of walking. So, and if there are any changes in your need for a ride or not that I haven't heard, please let me know right away in the morning so we can arrange for it.
With that, we are adjourned.